Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth, where we sort out the pop culture week from the rock and roll chaff. I'm Andrew Harrison, and as ever, I've got Sian Patton in with me. Pop culture expert, smash hit graduate, DIY arts impresario, she's the Lady Brian Eno. Sian Peter George St. John Le Baptiste de La Salle Patton, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Funny you should mention Brian Eno, I once did give him a protest biscuit.
Did you?
He looked at it quizzically. Yeah, he's got power to the people.
If you're Brian Eno, you can't look askance at an art happening if you're Brian Eno, for God's sake.
It's just his sort of thing.
It's exactly the sort of thing. You're lucky you didn't get invited into a collaboration.
Oh, I'm waiting.
Biscuit collaboration.
That phone is yet to call. Yeah.
Put the cream on the outside. Ooh. Exciting news in conventional rock, Sian. Apparently sales of guitars have increased 20% since The Cure did Glastonbury. Is this a good thing?
I don't know if I'm slightly horrified by that.
No, it is not.
It is a bit of a... I'm just wondering if a load of Stormzy fans are going to look at that and invent goth grime.
Maybe. Aren't Stormzy fans going to go and buy an enormous grand piano? Pretend to be Chris Martin as well as Stormzy.
I don't know.
Quite good. Piano sales up, that would be quite nice.
Piano sales are up, yes. All you need is three chords and a grand piano.
Exactly.
Well, I think that was great. That was good because Glastonbury is literally the only place you hear music you weren't looking for these days. It's the only place you'd encounter music not via search, yeah. I think. Sian, who's joining us today?
Funny you should ask. He's the author of Mars by 1980, the story of electronic music as well as Future Days, Krautrock and the building of modern Germany. Ooh. He was Melody Maker's Mr. Abusing as well. He's quite nice, really. And now he writes for The Wire, The Quietus and When Saturday Comes. It's David Stubbs. Welcome back to Big Mouth, David.
Hello, David.
You're having fun with Morrissey fans this week, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
What's been happening?
I did a piece for The Quietus, essentially suggesting sort of a little play on the old Special AKA thing about if you have a racist friend, now is the time for that friendship. And I sort of changed that. If you have a Morrissey-loving friend, now is the time. That, you know, and Morrissey fans, when it comes to thickness, that's not something you'd say about their skins, definitely.
And they're a very forgiving bunch, David. They really are broad-minded.
They're very bad for is, you know, I was compared, you know, that I was jumping on a kind of cash-grabbing bandwagon, according to one of them.
Right. Yeah, all that right, cash yeah. you've got.
The bottle funds of the quietest, well-known.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, and I was kind of... I was a sheep, you know. I was kind of, you know, a conformist, narrow-minded. You know, this is the classic.
So you're not
one.
A cash cow. You're a cash sheep.
Yeah, I was a cash sheep.
Well-known,
that's right. Yes,
money-earning animal.
Yes, exactly. Yes,
yes.
I traversed the whole barnyard of, you know,
perfidy.
Yeah, narrow-mindedness was another one that came up. Oh, yeah, unlike Morrissey's own sort of very broad-minded, malleable kind of, you know, ever-shifting worldview.
What do you think makes Morrissey fans so undoubting of their king?
It's hard to say, and I mean, they don't really tend to sort of.
What is it that they've got?
I know they don't really necessarily grapple with the specific sort of accusations leveled against him. You know, it's an idolatry that runs deep. Very, very similar actually to Michael Jackson fans as well.
Now, you have a point.
Oh, they're pretty bad. I remember doing a review when he played Wembley Stadium back in 1988, and you know. It was pretty laudatory. I may have dropped in one or two sort of irreverent little quips or whatever.
Like,
and I was getting calls. I was getting kind of assailed with calls next day, calling me like the C word, basically, you know, like over and over and over. They were bitterly, bitterly angry. And that was for a good review.
There's a connection they have, isn't there?
Yeah, it's something clearly to do with the nature of idolatry and fandom. I don't necessarily think it's an association. In the case of Morrissey, with his particular beliefs.
It may have got that far removed.
Interesting.
Also with us is a recovering Morrissey fan, thank God. It's film critic Linda Merrick, who edits screenwords.co.uk and writes for Hey You Guys, Empire, The Jewish Chronicle and all the good film outlets. Hello, Linda. Welcome back.
Hi.
Did you find it hard to let go of the Nigel Farage or Wally Rain?
Not really, actually. As soon as I sort of started to get a whiff of his, of who he really was, I just pulled away. I haven't been able to listen to his music. I mean, it was quite actually nice and refreshing to hear Johnny Marr, Glastonbury playing all the sort of the Smith songs.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed just sort of listening to songs that I loved, sang by someone I respected, rather than someone who's associated himself with the sort of any old fascist.
When did you get off the Morrissey bus?
I'd say about 6-7 years ago.
Right. Yeah,
possibly longer. 6-7 years ago. Shame.
I have a proposition. Let's never talk about Morrissey on the podcast ever again.
That's an idea.
Later in the show, we're going to be talking about the movies Midsommar, The Woke Wicker Man, as nobody's calling it for the festival generation, and The Brink, a fly on the cocoon wall documentary about corpulent political supervillain Steve Bannon. But Linda, what other movies should we be getting excited about this one? What's coming up that's good?
I really loved the new Joanna Hogg movie, which I'm sure not everyone is going to take to, which is called The Souvenir, mm-hmm. which is a 2-hour long sort of introspective sort of narrative about her upbringing, but her 20s and how she made it into film and this relationship she had with this sort of really weird weird older guy. I absolutely loved it, and I think people, she's like the Marmite of film directors, really. You either love her or you hate her, but I really liked it. What else have I seen that I can actually talk about? I mean, I've just seen the sort of the new Nikola Tesla Edison film, which I can't really talk about.
Right, this is Tesla now, as in the inventor of discoverer of electricity.
I can't really talk about it.
Under embargo.
Under embargo. Mm.
But do the thumbs up or thumbs down, and we'll
Speaking of art house, difficult movies that people really find a challenge to get into. What did you make of Spider-Man Far From Home?
I liked it. I didn't love it. I did like it. I liked it. I think what the difference between the first one, which I absolutely loved, I think it's because it was also John Hughes-y, very sort of Ferris Bueller's Day Out. I think the second one felt a bit like a filler, rather than sort of transitional story, rather than a story of its own. I just didn't find it interesting enough.
Jake Gyllenhaal, though.
Oh, he's brilliant. I loved it. Mm. I just didn't think it was a bit of a meh story, really. Mm. Didn't you?
I really enjoyed it, but then I'm a sucker for Spider-Man. I think he's clearly the best Spider-Man we've had. And I the whole, how's he going to get on with no Tony Stark anymore? He's a little bit lost in the world. Yeah. And I liked the double switch on Mysterio, who I think, it's not a spoiler to say, Mysterio turns out not to be what you expected. Clues in the name, Mysterio.
Yeah.
But my favourite was definitely Night Monkey.
Yeah.
He's a Spider-Man in his black outfit, and they go, it's an easy bird. It's the Night Monkey. So, more Night Monkey.
And
I think.
Zendaya, who's brilliant, who I think should be a superhero as well, I think. It's a shame that she's.
I was presuming she's going to turn into one at some point.
At some point.
Let's see.
An immensely sarcastic superhero.
Yeah.
This week, as well as folk horror and political horror, we're going to lighten the mood by choosing our ultimate summer albums and summer tracks. And in the extra bit, there's going to be a bonus extra selection of an additional summer album to take you around the beach with. We're going to put as many tracks as we can find on a Spotify list that you can find on our Facebook page. Before we do that, attention Patreon supporters, the exclusive new Big Mouth mugs are on their way now to our longest lasting backers. And potential new supporters, if you sign up to back the show on the £10 a month tier, we'll send you one too after your first couple of months. You'll be helping us to cover our studio bills. And as you can tell from the show pictures, the studio's a bit fancier now. Lovely new Soho Radio. And you'll get the podcast at least a day early too, so you can listen on the way home on Friday night instead of having to fight with the family on Saturday mornings. And of course, there is the fabled extra bit too, with additional Big Mouth to tide you over the weekend. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more, or see our Facebook page. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
Okay, let's start with the movies. And Midsommar, the extremely unconventional Scandi folky psycho horror movie, just released last week. Written and directed by Ari Aster of Hereditary notoriety, it follows Dani, a young American woman who's getting over a personal tragedy, plus her boyfriend and his entourage as they visit an apparently innocuous folk festival in Sweden. But things, you will be amazed to learn, are not all as they seem. Does Midsommar take horror to new places? And will you ever dare visit the Llama Tree Festival or listen to the Bodhran again? Hey, nonny nonny, here's the trailer.
Christian says that you've got some special thing planned.
Yeah, it's like a crazy 9-day festival. It only happens every 90 years.
Hi. Hello. Theodore. You can't speak. You can't move. But this opens you up to the influence. And it breaks down your defenses. trust me. Right? You're gonna love it.
Merry meet, blessed be, and watch out for the brown mushrooms. That was Midsummer, a.k.a. Let's All Go to the End of the Road Festival and Get Murdered, which is not really a spoiler, as you don't go and see a movie like this without knowing that someone is going to get it. The question is, of course, who, how, why, and to what soundtrack? Linda Marrick, let's start with you. You are a film critic. Our setup here is a real clash of worlds. American psychology student Danny experiences a truly horrific family trauma, and in the name of getting her head together, she accidentally goes to a pagan retreat among a community called the Haugers with her boyfriend and his douchey mates. What did you think of Midsummer?
I absolutely loved it. I mean, I loved Hereditary, but I really loved Midsummer. I know there is, people are saying, oh, it's The Wicker Man. Of course it is. It borrows heavily from The Wicker Man. And that's why you know exactly what's going to happen. It's not the guessing what's going to happen. It's the knowing exactly what's going to happen.
Yes.
But how do we get there?
Yeah.
And I just think he's done such a fantastic job with this. The juxtaposition of sort of the dark subject matter and the light, you know, very sort of...
Literally light because we're in northern Sweden and the longest day, which you get 2 hours of darkness. Yeah. It's not even really darkness.
And I really loved it. I think it's also a film not about what it is. You know, it's not... It's in the great tradition of great horror movies of sort of sliding ideas in there that aren't explicitly in the screen. So it's a film about sort of gaslighting. It's a film about breakup. It's a film about sort of men behaving badly. But, you know, I absolutely loved it. I think he's just I think he's a genius, in my opinion. And he's just getting better and better every time. I think there's also a very unsettling air about the film. I think you feel like, from the moment they step in, and I don't want to, like, you know, sort of spoil it for anyone, but then the moment they step into this village, you know that things are going to go really wrong for them, and it's completely out of their hands. And I think that's the thing I love about it, is that they can fight, they can sort of try, and they don't actually fight. They stay the same all the way through. It's just him. I love the sort of the juxtaposition of people knowing exactly what's going to happen and them not knowing at all what's going to happen. I think that is brilliantly well done with him.
Yes.
As well.
There's a wonderful shot where you see the journey, not for very long, but it's a long journey from the airport to the northern Swedish village. It's not even a town. And they're using drones or something, and the drone follows the car and then just flips 180 degrees upside down. And then you go, okay, we've gone into the different world. This is the fantasy world. David, what were your thoughts? Is this actually a horror movie?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was going to mention that scene as well. Yeah, that was one of my favourite shots, actually. I'm probably not quite as keen as Linda on it. Primarily, I think, for the length, it's about 2.5 hours. I mean, I saw it last night at an 8:30 screening. I thought that'd be fine, whatever. And by the last 20 minutes, I was googling for night buses.
Bless you!
You know, I just think, mate, you could have lost an hour from this. Oh, that would be amputation, liposuction. You know, that was my particular thing. I think I'm probably not the only one that's kind of felt like it. It did seem it could have been brought in. It was a film that was a little bit in love with itself, in a sense, and thought we can linger on this, but with good reason. Having said that, it's beautifully shot. The soundtrack is superb, and it could be a sort of standalone sort of, you know,
it's Hacks and Cloak, isn't it?
That's right,
yeah,
exactly.
Hacks and Cloak bloke, yes.
Ooh,
yeah,
tell me
all
more
of those things. But, you know, having said that, yes, there are, you're absolutely right about the gaslighting and like that. There are various themes about sort of men being, you know, horrible, etc., etc. And I think that's part of. I mean, in a sense, films like this are a sort of ritual in themselves—the ritual punishment of North Americans, North Americans,
yes,
Blair Witch Project, etc., etc. And it's like the first 20 minutes, so it seems to establish not so much to get interest in these people, but to show how uninteresting and unengaging they are, so that they're going to get what's coming to them. You know, for being
a little bit too wealthy, solipsistic.
Yeah, that's right.
Into a
so
movie.
That's a kind of classic thing. You just show that these people are kind of mildly kind of irritating, and you know, a bit wealthier than they ought to be, you know, just, you know, like in these nice apartments and just going off to Sweden on a whim and what have you.
Yeah. I also want to mention how brilliant Florence Pugh is.
I was just
She's just amazing. I mean, she's been great in every single thing she's been in so far. I think the role is not an easy role to take on, and she's in almost every scene.
Yes,
so I think that just shows how brilliant. I mean, I don't know if you saw her in Lady Macbeth, which was like a loose adaptation of the Shakespeare, she was just the best thing in it. I mean, she's amazing. I mean, both of them, actually, both like principal actors are great.
And I think, as with a horror movie, it focuses on her face almost a lot. Yeah. Not all the time, but it's about her reaction and it's her story, is what I found really interesting. Yeah. Andrew, are you still having sleepless nights?
No, I was absolutely. I loved it. I was thrilled and amazed by it. If you want a 2.5 hour polyphonic spree, go Waco extended KLF video with loads of gore and death and resurrection. I just thought it was incredible. I also sort of, I'm not really sure whether it really is so much a horror movie as a psychological journey.
Yeah, I wasn't remotely scared at any point.
It's like, really? Well, you're supposed to say stuff
from
there.
That's from the north.
I was terrified. Not that far north, David. Not up with
they
don't have the midnight sun
in
Leeds today.
Edgeware. Some of the more graphic stuff was kind of horrifying.
I mean, the deaths, there's a limited number of deaths.
Fair to say there are a lot of deaths.
And the camera does not shy away. But I think that's all to do with essentially taking these sort of city academia Americans and really rubbing their face in the grit, blood, bone, you know, fat and dirt of reality. Because that's essentially what is happening here. A woman has experienced a traumatizing, horrific event, which Florence Pugh carries off so paralyzingly, brilliantly.
Yes.
And then taking her into fairyland, into the underworld, into the realm of dreams and imagination and ritual and tradition and all that kind of stuff. And her journey through that, I mean, the final scene, if you've seen it, you'll see the final decision she has to make is everything about the film. There is a twee rote pat solution to that movie, which she does not take. She takes the other road instead, and I thought that was amazing, particularly the very, very final shot where her entire experience is kind of explained by her face. I just thought it was just brilliant. And it is so beautiful to look at, the colours, the light, the production design, the detail, to the extent that whatever foreground action is taking place, there's another mad ritual taking place in the corner of the screen. Yeah. You never really fully understand what it is.
Yeah. One more thing. How it was very funny.
So yeah, there's
it's
a lot
a
of
black comedy.
Deadpan
almost.
Humor in there, yeah.
I mean, I was very amazed because you know, there was a lot of sort of mystery around it, and I didn't know whether he was going to go full hereditary again. Mm. So it was quite refreshing to sort of have so much funny stuff in it.
There were a lot of laughs. I mean, when I saw it last night, and there were quite a few laughs. I sort of took that as in a sense that people knew, again, going back to the thing of the kind of ritual of that kind of movie, and I think that people are laughing because they see the comeuppance, you know, occurring and what have you.
Yeah. But it's interesting that, I mean, everybody's sins are paid, aren't they, of the visitors? But they're not the conventional one. It's not the conventional, hey, let's go swimming in the pool after dark. Oh, no, the lake monster's got me. They're actually, her boyfriend and his awful mates, their sins are much more kind of minor but believable and contemporary. And, you know, one particular character transgresses a rule he does not even know he's transgressing and pays for it dreadfully fully deserves it.
I mean, this is why I said, like, I loved the idea of them, of the people, the villagers, knowing exactly what was going to happen at every single step. Mm. And the other guys, the outsiders, just,
they don't
you know.
But we know. And what's interesting is how much it, from the start, the film is foreshadowing what's going to happen.
Yeah.
There are pictures on the wall of Danny's house and the houses in New York before they go, which tell us what's going to happen. Yeah. There's the amazing shot, which is very slow and it's not narrated or given anything, but you see that tapestry. And that's one of the storylines is revealed in the tapestry hours before it happens, because it's a long film.
Yeah.
Things like that, the absolute attention to detail, I just loved. Mm. The colour, we're talking about the colour palette. The Americans arrive in blue and everyone's in white. Mm. And you see people either assimilate or not through colour as well. Those sorts of filmmaking, filmmaking details are just sound in it is very good as well. The breath. So they
just
use breath. I mean, there's so much.
There's one scene in which they're still in the apartment in America and she starts to get teary and goes to the loo, and suddenly She's crying in the toilet, but it's not where you think she is.
Yeah. Nice
I think
cut.
That's just an amazing
sequence. That was another good
sequence.
Cut.
Yes.
And also that sense that trauma that she experiences in the very first film has made everything unreal. It's made the real world unreal, and you're kind of dragged
along.
It's about
her trauma. And I think one of the most interesting, I thought it's from the women's point of view and it's from the female gaze. There is a ritual scene where something happens with the boyfriend and someone else.
Quite a scene, that, isn't it?
It's quite a scene. But there is no point that you ever are getting it from his point of view, which is really rare for a scene like that. And even she comes and gazes through a keyhole and that kind of magical Grimm's fairy tale. Mm. And it's her journey, I thought was so important and so lovely in a film like that.
While we're alluding to scenes that we can't explain because it will ruin it, but if you've seen it, you'll know the scene. There's a very big British Sea Power bear related moment in this film. If you like British Sea Power and you're into your bears, there's a major, major bear moment. I thought, by the way, the appearance of the bear, I thought that was the first appearance of a Chekhov's bear ever in drama. We know about Chekhov's gun. There's a gun on the table. It's going to be used at some point. At no point have we seen a Chekhov's bear before. It's that great scene. They're walking through the centre of the village and they've had a big old, discussion about something or other. And then they walk past a caged bear and somebody goes, so we're just not going to mention the bear then?
Yeah, that was... I loved the... obviously, the sheer sort of blazing luminosity of it, the anti Game of Thronesness, as it were, kind of the light is great. I did wonder if at some point there was going to be like some sort of dubious otherness of Europeans or whatever, but I thought they got the kind of sweet, I thought in terms of like their dialogue and when they spoke was absolutely sort of down pat from that sort of good, sort of urbane contemporary hume, to the more kind of ritualistic stuff. It didn't feel like, that the sweet were being othered,
I came out of the film, must say, in daylight, because I'd seen it in a daytime to the world. It really does affect you. I think, Linda, you were saying before that you're still thinking about it.
Like, just when I think I dealt with every single aspect of it, every now and again I have one thought and I'm back into it. And it's really unsettling.
So I think that counts as an all-round recommendation, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Let's abandon the blood-soaked lingonberries and ritual pickled herring for a moment for some pop music. We always ask the guest to bring in a tune for your delectation. David Stubbs, what have you brought in for our delectation?
Flicking Cigarettes at the Sun. It's from what was possibly going to be the final Peru album. David Thomas has not been in very good health at all lately. And, it's called The Long Goodbye, Alan Chardin and that. And, he was extremely unwell. I think he wanted to kind of make an album that summed up all of the kind of themes that have been kind of consistent throughout Peru Ubu's career, despite his kind of ever shifting lineups and shifting styles or whatever. And, it's all been this kind of metaphorical journey across America, really, like the journey of life or whatever. And it finally kind of reaches Bay City, whatever, the actual terminus, much as he felt he was going to reach the end of his life. As it turns out, he's feeling a bit better, is David Thomas. So, despite the sort of air of finality about this album, there's probably going to be more from Peru Ubu.
Oh, right. So it's the kind of, like, Frank Sinatra endless farewell tour.
Diss it.
Okay, let's have a listen. This is Flicking Cigarettes at the Sun by Peru Ubu.
Yesterday haunts all your tomorrow. Flicking cigarettes at the sun. One more spark ought to see it done. Eucalyptus flames flickering through the streetcar names, block after block.
Okay, further lightning mood. It's summer. It never goes dark. Let's go to northern Sweden. Perhaps not. And for that reason alone, and not because there are precious few good new records coming out in these dog days, we're choosing our favourite summer music for you, the listener. Later on, we'll pick our favourite individual summer tracks. And on the extra bit, there's a bonus summer album each too. But first, we've all picked our favourite summer LPs. And here's what we went for.
Converted to nothing but stonewash. Now hopping in a barrel is a barrel of fun. But don't hop in if you want to be down, son. Because down can mean down and out is an action. What does it lead to? Dum, da, dum, dum. People say, what have I done for all my years? My tears show my hard-earned work. I heard shoving is worse than pushing, but I'd rather know a shover than a pusher, because a pusher's a jerk.
I'm hard to die in the 90s. It's town, and with each beam, the same old dream. And every stop that we made, oh, I thought about you. And when I pulled down the shade, then I really felt blue. I peeked through the crack and looked at the track, the one going back to you. And what did I do? I thought about you.
That was, obviously, Say No Go from 3 Foot High and Rising by De La Soul, as chosen by David Stubbs, and then Blur with Girls and Boys from Park Life, Linda Marrick's choice, and then some Frank Sinatra with I Thought About You from Songs for Swinging Lovers, as picked by me, and finally Andrew being perverse with the KLF's Chill Out album. The track was Transcentral, Lost in My Mind. So, David, you're an electronic fan. What makes a summer album?
Ooh. Good question. I think it's got to have a kind of, you know, palpable sort of sense of colour.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's got to be associated. Sometimes I think a summer album can be quite subjective. It could be an album that's associated with one of your own, you know, summers, mm-hmm. really. And, you know, and it can have, you know, that particular kind of association. I mean, there's nothing intrinsically summery, for instance, about, say, Don't Go Breaking My Heart from 1976. But if you were around at that time, it felt like a kind of 90 to 95 degree song, you know,
yes.
purely by association with the weather and the fact that it was so kind of ubiquitous. So I think that can be a kind of particular factor. But yes, I think it's got to have inherent in its kind of grain, you know, a sort of, you know, a sense of like a strong sense of sort of vitamin D, of colour, mm-hmm. of warmth. Not necessarily kind of optimism and anything like that particularly, but, you know, it can perhaps, you know, the odd cloud of melancholy or whatever. But, yeah, I think that essentially, you know, sort of warmth, energy, aliveness.
Yes. Interestingly, most of these albums aren't really let's go to the beach. Hey, hey, literal ice creams everywhere. They're just summery.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty miserable thought. If someone said, let's go to the beach, so, oh, God,
would you buy it?
Yeah.
3 Foot High and Rising, I agree with you. I think that is, it's just, it's bouncy. And as I say, it's colourful. There's something about the colour in there that infuses with the music and the whole De La Soul.
Yeah.
Daisy.
Well, this is it. And the whole nature of, you know, what was happening at the time, you know, and where they fit in the kind of history of hip hop. I mean, it's all about to go gangster. It's already just turned gangster, in fact, you
That's
know, with N.W.A.
Yes.
The whole sort of the early phase of people like that, Public Enemy look like they're going to sort of set to sort of rule the world, but they kind of fall away, you know, in the very early 1990s. And so you've just got this one particular moment that's always associated as well as what's happening in the UK with, you know, smiley culture, acid and everything like that. And that sudden sort of general worldwide sort of blaze of optimism, you know, that you associate with 1989, you know, that like after this kind of rather sort of dismal, fractious decade that we've just had, that things are about to kind of blaze forth. So I suppose, yeah, in the case of 3 Foot Rising, there is that sort of, you know, sense of the seeds of optimism and, you know, and the return of brotherly and sisterly love and what have you.
Yeah, absolutely. When did you first encounter it? Were you at the Maker?
I was, yeah. I interviewed them, in fact. Oh. I went out there, yeah. God, that was a weird week. I went to New York twice in the same week. I went to Bobby Brown on Monday, came back, and then went straight out again and interviewed De La Soul, who were playing in New York.
And how were they?
They were fine. It was interesting. They were backstage at just in this event, this kind of sorority type event there at the Jacob Javits Center, and Yeah, and they were kind of hanging out with LL Cool J, and they were talking about, I don't like his new album, and I'll tell him to my face, man. You know, it's part saying that, you know. Because what was happening, actually, because they were all kind of trippy and peace and love and all this kind of thing, what happened is, on early gigs, a lot of, like, sort of regular hip-hop fans thought they were a soft touch and tried to pick fights with them.
They were enormous, though, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And they beat the hell out of them. Yeah, they said, just because we do the two industries, don't think we can't handle ourselves. And eventually they got thrown off the LL Cool J tour as a result of basically being too violent.
Wow. They were the first band I ever interviewed. I was given a phoner because everyone knew they were so difficult, because I don't think they were great smash hits fans. And I just got one word answers. Fact. Now, ironically, you can't get this on any streaming services. Can you get it digitally? Because the samples are unclearable.
It's all just been reissued, right, actually, by Tommy Boy, because I actually did a feature about this, a record collector. And it's all just been reissued.
Oh. Did they clear the sample?
The sample situation, I think, eventually, where they came a cropper, I think, because Tommy Boy, you know, they've been very careful about the whole kind of sampling things, but the one sample that they got them on was a sample in one of the little skit type bits that they kind of inaugurated, and I think it was from a Turtles song. And it was just like they thought they'd cleared everything. It's a bit like, you know, when you sort of smash a glass and you sweep it up and you steam every last bit and then, you know, you step on the... It was like that, you know, they thought they'd swept it. You know, it wasn't like they'd paid no mind at all to the whole sampling issue. They thought they'd got everything cleared and one little one slipped through.
I see. So people can now hear it. And that's the good thing. And we can go and relive the summer of 1989, which was actually quite bouncy up and down. Linda Marrick, yours is similarly colourful. Yours is Park Life. It really did dominate the summer of 1994.
Yeah.
Why do you love it?
Bizarrely, when I went back, because I remember listening to this from start to finish in my hazy memory of 1994, which was very hazy. Having listened to it again this week after you've asked me to pick it, I just realised that I used to skip so many of the songs. So I ended up, I only really like a few out of Park Life, to be honest with you.
That's a very pop attitude.
I remember really liking Park Life, and although it's everyone goes on about sort of how sort of, you know, stereotypical, and whenever anyone mentions Blur, it's always Park Life. I think for me, it's End of Century or To the End that really stick out for me that summer. I just absolutely love both of them. And they are very sort of, they had this kind of freshness about them, cockiness of youth about them. And they still manage to seem likeable, as opposed to Oasis, who just seem just a lot very cocky, to be honest. You know, you either loved Oasis or Blur, and I was firmly in the Blur side. Just absolutely loved the album from start to finish, and I just remember them playing in Glastonbury in 1998 and playing quite a bit from this album, this particular album. So yeah.
It's a concept album, isn't it?
It is.
And yet you've skipped some of the tracks, Linda.
I did.
Yeah. And I mean, this is we're on a journey here.
I liked Bank Holiday, which is a, sort of a more like I want to say ska.
Sort of a thrashy thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think, and also, the interesting thing about it is that it has so many different genres in it. Like, it's got like synth pop, sort of punk rock, like ballads, you know, sort of more sort of like waltzy ballads. It's an interesting concept album, yeah.
Do you think this is Damon becoming a professional Cockney and selling London back to us, Londoners, many of us?
But Damon is a Cockney.
Do you
find
that hammy?
He's from Essex. I think people always go on about them being Mockneys. They were never Mockneys. That's how they spoke.
The real deal.
You know.
Yeah.
Essex is where all the Cockneys ended up, isn't it?
Being Essex to make you a real Cockney.
I've met Damon, and he's like that.
Exactly. You live in Bethnal Green now, and you're probably, you know, speaking with, you know, BBC sort of, you know, stateless.
Exactly.
Standard vowels. It did get colonised in a way. Lad culture kind of came and seized upon it. Could we see this? I mean, you know, I think it's been tainted a bit, Park Life.
Which is so bizarre,
Sorry, just brightly coloured drinking lager, sort of.
Yeah, it was so bizarre because now when you think of Damon, he's just so the least sort of blokey person. He's so open and he's very much into his world music, and he's very politically sort of, I don't know where the image, the blokey image came from.
They did disavow it quite quickly, didn't they? Because they tried to do Park Life Part 2 with The Great Escape, and it really didn't work. And there was a rapid rethink and disavowal. But then,
you know, David Bowie does that, and everybody goes, "Oh, great, well done, well done," said David, chameleon of pop, and Blur do it. They go, "You do it now. You don't believe in any of it, do you?"
Well, it all changes.
I'm a massive Blur fan. I love them. I love everything about them, and even when sort of, you know, when they've made sort of, you know, albums that I haven't liked, I still like them. So.
I don't think with Damon Albarn you think of Laddism these days. No. I think it was just a very brief, it was just part of the time. I know he played up to it at the time, he did.
Nuts culture,
but I think he's done
that.
So much else since, whereas Noel and Liam, you know, they're just degenerated into...
Exactly, into sort of a rich old men, you know.
Sean, you chose Song for Swinging Lovers by... Yes. Speaking of Endless Goodbyes, Frank Sinatra. what makes this your summer record?
Well, I get to a point, and I think it's a seasonal thing, and don't, you know... Don't get me wrong, I like a lot of music. I listen to a lot of music, especially new music. But sometimes I'm full. And I think this is quite a valid point. Sometimes you think, I have listened to enough new stuff, and someone recommends and this recommends. I need to go back and recalibrate. And summer is a time where I go back and recalibrate, and I listen to Songs for Swinging Lovers, and I might alternate it with the Wee Small Hours. But summer is Songs for Swinging Lovers. It is an incredible and much maligned because of the birth of rock and roll clashing with Frank Sinatra's career quite madly. It's beautifully orchestrated. Nelson Riddle is perfect against Frank Sinatra's voice. The music sounds... you know, as if it's been woven. It's a tapestry. It's absolutely beautiful. You can go back to it again. Also, Frank Sinatra, by this point, is old enough to have that experience in his voice. So when he sings a happy song, it's not a happy, happy song. There are these ripples underneath. Mm. There's this feeling underneath. And going back to him as a singer, somehow it sort of refreshes the palate. Mm. It's an amuse-bouche in the world of song. I ever find this not a fresh record to listen to, and a record that just makes you happy. There's something about it that gives you a spring in your step. A lot of it is about fancying people rotten. And he was a bit of a one at this point as well. He was, you know, there were a lot of leading
putting
ladies.
Putting yourself there. About a bit, yes.
He was enjoying himself. And there's something about the joy of that and the rebirth of his career after everyone had said it was over, and it was over for a while, I just think is glorious. And it, as I say, I repeat myself, it sounds fresh.
Is that what makes it a summer record then? Because he has reborn. You're getting back to your folk life cycles here, and
yes.
You're reborn in the spring, and
yes,
is now
absolutely.
Standing there covered in twigs and leaves, resplendent and replete for the summer.
Yes, he is the maypole around which we dance. Yes,
I would love to hear the Frank Sinatra Wicker Man album as Frank sings the cycles of life and death.
You never know.
Be great.
Also, it's imagistic, isn't it? Because of like, well, but the film work that both Nelson Riddle as a soundtracker, and of course Frank Sinatra, whatever. I think whether it's just that association, but it is very, very. You know, it paints pictures in your head.
It's also got an exclamation mark in the cover in the title, which is always really good for some records, and it's swinging. It's not swinging.
Swinging
lovers exclamation mark and things like that. It's got an orange cover, so that's very hot.
Swinging the old innocent sense.
Yes.
What are the standout songs that from the album?
So it has the classics. It Happened in Monterey. You Make Me Feel So Young.
Okay.
Too marvellous for words. I could
so
go
young.
On. Pennies from Heaven.
Yes,
I mean, you know, Making Whoopee. I mean, it's not my favourite one, but it is just, to say, beautifully sung. And someone else wouldn't give it the range and the depth that Sinatra
does. Got the range.
Yeah, he's such an incredible singer.
And that's another thing about a summer, isn't it? Summer's albums will remind you of previous summers. You know,
it is about memory and what you bring to it as much as what's being delivered.
Yeah.
Well, I've gone with the KLF's Chill Out, and because I'm a punt, it's a record you can't get.
Go on then.
Because it literally sounds like summer. There are cicadas and there are pedal steels and there are distant trains. It's basically the reconstruction of a road trip around America with, you know, Bill Drummond and Jimmy Cauty and their battered old car in the America of the mind. Obviously, they probably did it in some rotten shed in February somewhere. But it's, you know, it's a Heat Haze record, and it's being, you know, one of the sort of early ambient house things where it basically you take out the drums and the bass line and you just leave the kind of wafting effects. And also coming out at a time of very hot, very warm summers, and when I was still a student, it just feels like this sort of 60-minute album is a 12-hour personal mind journey experience. And what I love about it is that it's a bit of a time travel record as well, because loads of the little bits that fade in and fade out just faded up on them, Jimmy Cauty's mixing just faded out again. 3 years later or 2 years later would have been transformed into 3-minute mega bangers. Like the episode we saw that we had there, Transcentral, Lost in My Mind, I think it's called, turns into Last Train to Transcentral, which is the full woo, you know, with banging fire extinguisher, all the rest of it. So it's got this kind of deja vu thing to it, as well as kind of memory of the future thing on the go. It's introspective, it's cosmic. If you listen to it literally on a beach or in a hot back garden, it will enhance all that kind of thing. It's a road trip without leaving home, and I think that's a very summery thing.
It reminds me of Blue Room. Both records, I think, are very similar.
Yes, I was going to say, the first Orb album.
Yeah, very much
the long track on that, whose name I forget, I think Jimmy Courtney was involved with that.
The album's UFO, and the track is The Blue Room. And I recently found the 40-minute version of The Blue Room at the bottom of the box, a 40-minute long track.
But when that comes in, sorry, anyway.
Sound of Ice Cream Man's at Glastonbury in 1993.
I just love to chill out the way that things like, you hit with fragments of In the Ghetto and Strangers on the Shore and things like that.
Oh, Strangers on the Shore, which again, it's the storehouse of memory, which again is an immensely summery tune and all that kind of thing. So, unfortunately, you can't get it, though. It's about £300 on Discogs. Ha-ha. But search it. I mean, it's doubtless available on sharing sites somewhere. Chill out.
Is that illegal, Andrew?
It's illegal.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Yeah. So sue me. Anyway, let's get off the beach and back into the real world, allegedly, with Linda Marek's choice of tune. What have you brought in for the enjoyment of the listeners, Linda?
I brought in the new Thom Yorke, a song out of the new Thom Yorke album, Anima, and it's Impossible Knots.
Impossible Knots is the tune. Yeah. Because we talked about this last week, and it's fair to say divided the panel. We liked some of the music, and we found it's short film kind of risible. Have you seen the film?
I've seen the film,
What do you think? You're an actual film critic.
I did like the film, but I actually am more interested in sort of the sound. I like Paul Thomas Anderson, obviously, who doesn't? But I thought the album was great. As a fan of Thom Yorke, I think it's one of the best things he's done.
It's definitely, I think it's his best solo record, definitely.
Definitely, I really loved it. I loved the whole album.
Why this track in particular?
I don't know, I thought... Bizarre. I think it's a little bit. It's one of the most accessible in the album. And I just thought, I don't get me wrong. I do like sort of really sort of heavy minimal, like electronic stuff. But most of the time I do like a tune as well. So I think that's the most tuneful probably.
Well, let's have a listen. This is Thom Yorke with Impossible Knots. Back to the movies, and something possibly even more unpleasant than ritual killings in rural Sweden. At least the people there are pretty. The documentary The Brink follows Steve Bannon, right-wing ideologue, former Breitbart editor, hate figure to liberals, and let's be honest, no oil painting, as he attempts to create an international populist movement out of the dregs of extremist politicians from the US to Italy to Hungary. Along the way, we encounter a bestiary of international far-right figures, and we are treated to a close-up take of Bannon's own philosophy of economic nationalism. What's it like to spend 90 minutes in the company of one of the most odious figures in world politics? And what do we learn from it? We're going to talk about it after the trailer.
If I had not come as the CEO of the campaign, Trump would not have won.
And that's a fact.
The White House, there's no glamour to the job at all. I hated every second I was there.
God damn it.
Just stay focused.
I'm on a mission to convert as many people as possible.
You're part of a worldwide movement.
Take out the sword and throw away the scabbard.
I'm gonna get so crushed in this film.
This is what I've done for 40 years.
How you doing?
Hey. Every nationalist party that looks viable, I'm trying to help.
The key point is immigration.
Islam.
So-called refugees.
The real battle isn't in Washington. This is the future of all our states.
It's time for action.
Yes. It's a global revolt.
Some of the people you're doing business with here in Europe are connected to neo-fascism. Energizing hate. Hate black people. Hate Muslims. It's not right.
I actually thought I was doing the Lord's work.
Who is funding this group?
You're doing dog whistle anti-Semitism here.
I'm about one thing. I'm about winning.
Now, I'm guessing wildly that there are not too many Steve Bannon fans in the room. The Brink is out this week. Linda Marrick, this is one movie we can describe in detail without spoilers. We join Bannon and he's on the outs in Trump's inner circle. We see him sacked by Trump and labelled Sloppy Steve. We watch him meet with every far-right figure in Europe, including Nigel Farage, and the movie ends with the Republicans basically losing the 2018 midterms. On the face of it, it's kind of end of part one. What did you think of it as a film, as a piece of documentary making?
I mean, I was completely disgusted by him to start with, but by the end of it, I was optimistic because it all seemed like they were all falling apart a little bit. I don't know if anyone else had that kind of sense. I could see how insecure they were all about sort of losing it all. And I felt kind of, you know, happy at the end of it. I think when you're met with the awfulness of people like Raheem Qassam, who is just a little sort of, you know...
I thought he was the kind of salacious crumb to the Jabba the Hutt in this film, wasn't he? Capering little sidekick. Kind of laughable and odious at the same time.
Also, he hates him. So, you know, I kind of liked that it was what I loved the most about this. I know the director, Alison Klemming, was very heavily embedded, so she couldn't really say too much against him, and she couldn't really, you know, there were limits to what she could ask him, because otherwise he would have just, you know, pulled the plug on everything. What I loved was Paul Lewis from The Guardian. Bit where he was being interviewed by Paul Lewis in The Guardian, he was fine with him the first time he interviewed him. And I think that's a brilliant journalistic sort of, you know, way of doing things. Always go for the punch the second time you see them, the last time you go and see them. Otherwise, they're not going to see you again. But look out for that. If you go and see the film, look out for that bit.
It is interestingly shot, isn't it, in that it's the director shot it all herself and spent a long time, as you said, embedded. You do get into some very small spaces and some very intimate places, and you see some really quite unpleasant people being quite off guard and boasting about their achievements, their horrible, horrible achievements. We spend a lot of time in private jets. You spend a lot of time in elevators. And quite apart from meeting the people, you get to see the astonishing decrepitude of Steve Bannon. He's literally rotting to pieces before your eyes. It's horrible, isn't it? David, what did you think? Oh, you're a huge fan, aren't you?
Oh,
big fan
Steve,
of Bannon.
Yeah,
major
Steve,
fan.
I thought it was great. Steve Bannon, rather less so. I mean, yeah, physically it seems awful, but it does look like, you know, like Dorian Gray's got his picture in the attic and he looks like that's his face. He looks like Kenneth Clark has gone back 40 years in time and gone on a horrible 3 or 4 week bender that's left him utterly sort of like, you know, scrofulous and sort of. You see him when he's on a dietary kick at the beginning and he's drinking this horrible green glue, whatever stuff. But then later on, there's a rather telling shot where he's back on the old sort of, you know, mixed grill breakfast. You know, and it's almost like, you know, perhaps a sort of hint at his kind of complete lack of moral fibre. But it was fascinating. Yeah, I mean, obviously he's playing to the camera. You'd expect him to be on his best behaviour a lot of the time. But I think genuinely, he does think, you know, something you might encounter him, and if you didn't talk about politics for 40, 45 minutes, regard him as somebody that's fairly sort of likeable, sort of collegey and urbane. If you didn't get onto politics, because he has that kind of sort of slight hit man. You see him when he's at university, and he's dressed almost like a kind of Kurt Cobain.
I thought he looked like quite Sam
grungy.
Shepard
yeah.
or
it's
something,
not like sort of Jacob
Rees-Mogg,
you know, or there are certain other people on that wing, you know, who give themselves away immediately as what they are.
He's a film producer, he did.
That's right. He has a kind of fairly slick, urbane. I think you could kind of mix easily in sort of liberal company. And, you know, obviously the one thing with Fazey was his kind of appearance. But what's curious is I still don't quite know what motivates him, what impels him towards the far right. It seems like he's playing a game a lot of the time.
Racist.
He understands this. To what extent he personally and viscerally feels this, the way that some of the others do.
But I
just thought he was playing a game a lot of the time.
I think that is the strange thing about it, because people sort of talk, you know, The sort of standard objection to things like this is, oh, you must not humanise these awful people. I think it's a foolish thing, because you can paint an accurate picture of anyone and the audience has its own volition. What I found interesting about it was that you sort of, you know, yes, he is treating it as a game, but so are so many of the people around them. He seems to be in a world of people who are fundamentally racist authoritarians whose entire raison d'etre is to tell themselves and other people that what they're doing isn't racist or authoritarian. Yeah. It's an exercise in self-justification. It's an exercise in selling it back to themselves as well. Numerous occasions people talk about how witty and ironic and kind of self-deprecating Bannon is. And you just have to ask yourself why. I mean, yeah. Oh, yeah. And you also see the hollowness of it as well, because whenever he's photographed with a husband and wife couple, he shoves the woman in the middle and goes, "Ah, rose between two thorns." Oh,
It's very, pretty sleazy, certainly. Yeah. I mean, all of what I was saying earlier on, you could probably say about Hermann Göring or something like that. And it's interesting, right at the beginning, there's the bit where he's talking about Nazis and Auschwitz and like that, and just talking about, just musing on the idea that these are just ordinary people. These are just people who are completely detached from the sheer horror, who are just going methodically putting all this together. It was almost like a product of ingenuity, really. And they think, well, yeah, that's what you're embarking on, trying
to. The movie is great in just allowing a moment to hang there and go, so that the audience is going, yes, Steve, and he's got a lot of books about Hitler, hasn't he? There's a lot of books about Hitler lying around in this place. Sean, what did you think?
I thought it was incredible, the access that was got by Alison Claman, who obviously was keeping it completely neutral on the fence, and a lot of the film is just revealing who he is. Yeah. It does look like he's on best behaviour. He slightly loses it at one point and gets a little bit angry, but you know that that's not the half of it. There must be something else going on with him. We're seeing this public side. But what is just incredible is just an amount of far-right leaders around a table in a hotel in London where they have the blinds drawn so no one can see this secretive neo-Nazi stuff that does actually go on. I mean, it's jaw-dropping to actually have seen that and get that access. And then he's asked by Paul Lewis at The Guardian, and he fluffs this idea that he's been meeting with other leaders in Europe. It is incredible about how power works.
Another person who comes out of the film well is, I forget her name, Good Morning Britain. Yes.
Susanna Reid is brilliant.
Yeah. She absolutely hammers it. And he comes out in a daze.
It's tough.
Not knowing what to do with himself. And she's not playing it for laughs.
She's tough. Yeah.
She does not want to ingratiate herself.
Nothing appears Morgan now. That's interesting, that. Yeah. I thought they just focus entirely on her contribution. I think you're right. There is obviously a lot of the camera. And I'd have loved, if possible, to have seen more of a sense of his interior life. More of him sitting, you know, how does his face get in that state?
Late at night, the
dark sort of fountain of him is sort of like down necking old bottles of whiskey or whatever it is.
But don't you think, though, the real horror of this is he has no interior life, and he says so as much himself. Mm. You know, well, why? You know, I'm so energized by this. Why would I want to do anything else?
Yes. So he's in hotel after hotel. This is what we see. He's in Venice. Does he go and stroll around? Yeah. Does he go and take the boat? No, he sits in a hotel room and plots the.
And I think this is the key to a lot of this politics. It's not just authoritarian. It's nihilist.
Also,
it doesn't believe in anything.
It's almost like
believe in nothing. We're nihilists.
No, but it's almost like fandom as well. Yeah. The people around him. It's almost like people who sort of just. Happily believing in one thing and then,
But he's a loser, and that's what comes out of him. He's
a
loser.
What, though?
I mean, Donald Trump identified him as a loser.
You know what? I thought that, but then I looked at the real events that follow, the kind of artificial endpoint of this film. Bannon's advising Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
Bannon's still a loser. To gather money. Well, is he?
And hopefully he won't be around long because he'll have a heart attack.
I was kind of hoping we'd see one on film. He's banging his head on the thing. Anyway, we cannot end the show on such a downer, so we're not going to. We're going to get back to summer and talk about our individual summer tunes instead, the ones that get you vibed up. What have we chosen and why? Here are some excerpts. We're going to put them on a playlist for this week's show.
I'm
a big day for the Avalanches. That was them with Since I Left You, of course, as chosen by Linda Marek. Then Sean's selection of top summer tune, Gordon Lightfoot with Sundown. Then more Avalanches, Saturday Night Inside Out, David's choice. And then a rousing crescendo of McCallman and Butler with Falling from their reunion album, Bring It Back, as selected by me. Linda and David, what is it about the Avalanches? It's just because it's summer in Australia always.
To be honest, I was like, I had completely forgotten about the Avalanches. And then at the weekend, I was listening to Six Music, and Since I Left You came on, I was like, oh my God, I used to love this. This whole album was absolutely brilliant. And then when you asked me about sort of, and it reminds me, it's a tune that reminds you of summer. It's very summer.
It's another one that sounds like summer. Yeah, it sounds like a cruise ship. Like summer. Yeah.
It sounds like a, sort of people in the background and things going on and people on the beach. I loved it.
Some beauteous optimism, and it is a proper classic. Famously constructed on cheapo box samples from the charity shop they've got in Australia, and then they just stopped. And 16 years later, they made another record by which they sounded retro. From which you're
absolutely, yeah. I mean, the thing about the Avalanches is I've made a point of like really not bothering to find out much about them, what their names are, what's on their biography. I just sort of regard them as this wonderful sort of very pleasant sort of ridge of high pressure, this lovely force of nature, really. And yeah, summer, it's teeming and droning and drowsy with the whole spirit of love. And yeah, and you do get the kind of distant sort of, midsummer, where you've got all these kind of little events happening in the background and things like that. You always get that, they're out so kind of layered. And Saturday Night Inside Out very much feels like that. And I played that last summer, or was it the summer before, in fact, on a permanent loop almost, and it just created this idea of this sort of imaginary beach party somewhere, and this is kind of like recurring riff, in which people are kind of like holding hands and and doing kind of oblique dance steps and what have you. Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. So the tune for your acid Barbie, definitely. Sean, Gordon Lightfoot.
Oh yes, this is me going back.
This is you abjuring rock and roll.
Yes, well I do. I could go on a summer holiday and I don't listen to rock and roll. Yeah, 1974 smash number one hit, Gordon Lightfoot, who is known as an easy listening singer and songwriter. But he's more than that. He's like a country star. The songs are so infused with not just a melancholy, but the complication of human relationships. And this is about that summer come down feeling. When it's getting...
Is it that summer feeling that's going to haunt you?
Sort of. When it's dusk, got gin and tonic in your hand, and you're actually ruining the day. Those summer feelings, if you just think, OK, I made that choice. My own religion.
Slightly too much information to Sean's world here, but never mind.
That's right. He's singing about Scarlet Woman. The lyrics are just beautiful. There's an amazing Scott Walker version. It just fills me with lots of different, rich, complicated, aren't humans a bit weird? It's a beautiful song. I think everyone should listen to it. I think have a little holiday from
Well, they can, because it's going to be on the playlist. We're sticking it on the playlist.
Good.
Have a listen if it's on Spotify, which I hope it is.
What did you choose then, Andrew Harrison?
What I chose is Falling by McCallum and Butler, because summer is for soul music. Mm. And this was from their reunion, because they made this fantastic album in the mid-90s and then fell out and reconvened in 2002 to kind of readdress the central project, which is, can you do a modern Supremes with two blokes in it? And McCallum has this incredible, soaring, beautiful voice, capable of capturing all the drama and passion of a huge summer love affair. This thing came out in summer 2002. Again, they made the record in February or January or December or something. Doesn't matter. Context is everything. And it does feel like a mega string-driven, modern Supremes. And I just wish they'd stayed together and kept making records like this, because these are the records that they were born to make. And, Falling is basically a sequel to Yes anyway. It's the same trope, same everything. Yeah. And it's just fantastic.
What summer drink do you listen to this with?
Well, so I drink the same
do
as
you
I drink.
Drink this.
Oh, well, this one. Yeah. Same as everything, just an IPA, because I'm boring.
I imagined you with a cocktail.
No, I don't do Negronis.
Right, that's the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. Woo! What will our guests be discussing over a tiny glass of special tea to help your dancing with the Haugus community in northern Sweden? Linda Marek.
Oh, actually, I wanted to talk about this. There's been sort of a tweet going around saying the top five domestic hits of 2019 so far, I think it's mostly America, have been all Disney films. Avengers and Endgame, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, Captain Marvel. Number three, Aladdin. Number four, Toy Story 4. Number five, Spider-Man Far From Home. And which made me think, what do we think of this new Disney monopoly? Are we... do we just sort of think, yeah, it's fine, you know, they're making good movies and that's the reason why they're selling tickets? Or should we be scared about the future of cinema and smaller productions not getting a look in? I don't have an opinion either way, because I liked all of those films and I personally saw them, and I have encouraged people to go and see them. But I'm interested in knowing what other people think of them, really.
Well, I suppose the question of the huge blockbuster has to be a family film now.
Yeah.
It has to be something that mum, dad and the kids will go and see. And the genius of modern movie making is that, you know, all of those quadrants generally satisfied. All those films you mentioned are really good. You know, there's nothing in it that, I mean, you look back at summer blockbusters in the past, and many of them have been moronically insulting. You know, we don't get Independence Day or you know, Godzilla the 90s version anymore. We get smart, clever, funny, sophisticated, and also full delivery action movies and family things like that. Yeah, I mean, it's a shame that you know in a perfect world Booksmart would be at the top of that,
but it didn't do very well, and it's
a shame that things like that don't get traction. But I suppose looking at summer blockbusters is a bit like looking at the top six in the Premier League and going, wouldn't it be great if Tranmere Rovers could break in? Well, they can't, but it'd be great if Tranmere Rovers could play Championship football at some time.
I think
except Tranmere Rovers are where they are because they're rubbish.
I think it's a little bit
work with me, David.
No, no, more serious than that, because with Disney, I mean, having sort of taken over Fox as well, it just makes me feel that sort of everything's just going to be Disneyfied from now on.
But is there
for eternity? And it just worries me a little bit that as a film critic,
I can understand that. But does Disney really sell these days an ideology as such?
No.
What they sell, what tends to be quite
positive,
diverse and quite
positive,
inclusive, and you know, outsiders are included, and good behaviour is rewarded, and honesty, and these kind of things. Yeah. I mean, you could live in many worse worlds. You know, imagine if you'd sort of ended up in this Randite world where Disney behaved like the caricature corporation and everything was promoting horrible individualism. I don't know, but it's closing time chatter. We're supposed to chatter about
there you go.
David Stubbs, what have you got for us?
Well, yeah, I wanted to talk about this production, Rutherford and Sons, which is currently playing at the National Theatre. Partly because generally I, to my shame, go to the theatre very, very infrequently, you know.
But that's because it's really expensive.
No, the price at this start, I mean, that's part of the problem, I suppose, I mean, you can get tickets for this. I think they go down to about 15 quid, but God knows what he's seeing, you know, for that. But, it's just a fabulous production, I think, is worth flagging up, because it's a play that was written in 1912 by this woman, Geetha Sowerby, and it's set in a sort of glass-blowing factory, and it's owned by this great sort of patriarchal tyrant played by Roger Allam, you know, from The Thick of It, Peter Mannion. I'm going to get a bloody Kit Kat. it's a very feminist play, and, you know, ahead of its time. And in fact, it kind of dropped almost immediately out of favour. It was, like, very popular in its time, and then was completely neglected for years and years, right up until about 1980, primarily because it's got female playwright. I think the great reason there, it wasn't sort of deemed to be part of the canon. It doesn't get revived very often. It's on at the moment. It's a superb production in many ways. Roger Allam is absolutely fantastic, because although he is this kind of horrible tyrannical figure, he's very engaging as well. He brings a lot of Allam, he brings a lot of bits of Mannion as well in his kind of moments of occasionally pertinent exasperation with his two rather weakling sons. There's also wonderful reveals to why he's got two sons, why it's actually called Rutherford and Son, which I won't talk about. But also another aspect of it is the music. There's this brilliant composer, Kerry Andrew, and she creates this wonderful sort of choral folk interludes that occur actually before it's actually worth arriving 20 minutes early, because part of, you know, it's composed for, like, you know, that particular section as well as the interval, and to mark this sort of passing between the acts. And I just think it's, you're right, I mean, theatre is very, very expensive, sadly, but it's a really marvellous production, and if you only go to the theatre once a year, let's face it, I would thoroughly recommend it. It's on throughout August, and it just makes me think about what is happening in theatre, the possibilities of theatre.
I'm going to break the rule of a lifetime. In defence of Ringo, a fantastic tweet this week from Mark Lewis and the Beatle expert, which Joel Morrissey writes the Grown Up Ladybird books he'd found. And the tweet goes, Ringo wasn't even the best drummer in the Beatles, was never said by John Lennon. Jasper Carrot's office claimed it as a 1983 gag.
proof now that it was said earlier in 1981 BBC comedy Radioactive, voiced by Philip Pope, written by Geoffrey Perkins, not by John Lennon. So the endless calumny, which is bloody wrong anyway.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Completely stupid and wrong. This idea that Lennon would have gone, oh, Ringo wasn't even the best drummer in the Beatles. Not only is it wrong, but he didn't say it. And nobody else in the Beatles said it either. So the next time some bore in the pub says to you, you know what? Ringo wasn't even the best drummer of the Beatles. Say, you know, John Lennon didn't say that.
The trouble is, they're comparing him in a sort of bombastic sort of 20-minute solo. It's like John Bonham or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. The worst thing, you know, can you imagine Keith Moon playing drums in the Beatles? It would be abominable.
Yeah,
absolutely horrible. You don't want that.
No, you don't. No. The first person to actually explain this properly, not to me directly, but that I saw, was Phil Collins. Mm. Now, I don't have a very high opinion of Phil Collins in all kinds of ways, but as a drummer, I'll listen to him.
Yeah, he knows his onions, yeah. Yeah. Can you imagine Phil Collins in the Beatles as well?
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely not.
I was imagining that gorilla from the ad.
Sean, what have you got?
Well, it's a Glastonbury story. I'm afraid to bring that up again. But I was looking at the BBC News, and there is a story about the singer Sigrid, who noticed a girl in the crowd at Glastonbury. And it's quite difficult to notice people in the crowd at Glastonbury because it's so big, but she's near the front, crying through the whole set, knowing all of the lyrics, and being a super fan. So Sigrid tried to get to find this person and put out a call on Twitter and found her. This person's my neighbour. This is Nina, who lives down my road, who I know quite well. And I saw this piece and it was just, you know, just when news cheers you up. Nina is now going to see with her dad, Sigrid, at Latitude and going to meet her before and after. And they've you know, somehow they've linked up. She was just a really big mega fan, really excited to see her. Got her dad to take her. She's 13 to Glastonbury for the weekend. And it's just such a lovely story. And I was like, oh my God, I know you.
And also the lad who got called up on stage at Glastonbury is going to be the new performer in the album in its entirety, isn't it? They're all going to be doing it. Robert Smith calling people up.
Absolutely. There's a lovely picture of her with the set list that she got afterwards as well that someone gave her from security. So good on you, Nina.
Fantastic.
I think she should rule the world now. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Absolutely. All right. That's the end of the show. Linda and David will be staying around for the extra bit to choose some more summer records. Are we feeling that we've sufficiently purged the horror of Steve Bannon and pagan sacrifice? Would we like to offer Bannon up to the land gods, perhaps? All the crops may fail. Thanks to coming in, Linda and David. Thanks to our producer, Alex Rees. And for me and Andrew, thanks for listening.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.